welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And today's icebreaker question was inspired by a piece I read about how the LA Police Department chief wants all their policemen to have some form of cyber training, and that's because we're all leaving a huge digital trail and it's helping them solve cases wherever they go. And so tell us, outside of our Google searches, where we might leave a digital trail but not know it.
Hi, this is Mike Buckby. And I think something a lot of people don't realize is that the social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, they actually track you on a lot of different websites because those websites include a share button. And oftentimes those share buttons report back that, oh, Mike Buckby, you went to, you know, Forbes, Mike Buckby, you went to Wired.com. And they use that to sort of shape the information they're showing you, as well as having a record of it.
Hi, this is Killian. I think at this point, the list would probably be much shorter if we just told you what wasn't tracking us. I have an old Slinky that's probably not tracking everything that I'm doing. So that, you know, that might be it. But kind of to allude to what Mike said, almost every web page we go to nowadays has some form of tracking. I was just reading an article, and Cindy, you and I talked about this the other day, but some websites are even starting to record what you enter into forms even before you submit it. So, you know, even if you decide not to click that submit button, there's a lot of scripts that run on there that capture this information anyway. So you kind of just have to be careful everywhere. And that's not to mention your, you know, cell phone in your pocket, which probably records your physical location everywhere you go too.
This is Mike Thompson, and I'm going to go right off what Killian just said, is the location services on your phone. This is something I only recently found out in the past year or so, but unless you manually turn off certain location services options on Google Maps, if you have the Google Maps application on your mobile device, it's tracking your every step, whether you know it or not. And you can see a history of places you've been in the past day. It's almost like a family circus cartoon of seeing where you've been walking. So yeah, you're being tracked all across the globe.
Thanks, guys. As always, our housekeeping announcement is, if you're a regular listener and enjoy our show, please go to iTunes to rate and review the Inside Out Security Show, and we'll put you in the running for a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. So let's go to today's show. Last week, we talked about GDPR, and I like the idea of a lot of things, especially this regulation, because consumers have a kind of protection they need. But one thing that makes meeting that compliance really difficult was there was a report that said 85% of businesses is in the dark about their data. It's, I think, reported higher than what I've read in other places. There was a gathering event in North Carolina, and only 6 out of the people in the room, I think, I can't remember how many, but maybe 60 in the room, that they weren't even aware of GDPR. And the biggest problem about meeting that compliance is they don't know where that data came from, how they might use it, if there's any business value associated with it. We've talked a little bit about it in the past where, you know, when storage got really cheap, people just started collecting everything because they thought they might use it later. And to me, it's a lot like money. Like if you start getting a whole bunch of deposits in your checking account and you don't know where it comes from, wouldn't you want to know if that money is legal, who it came from, what you plan to do with it? What are your suggestions and thoughts about how to approach this dark data problem?
First off, Cindy, if you just get random deposits in your account of money, let me know how to sign up for that if you figure out where it came from. And you know what? Maybe don't ask questions. Just, you know, hop on a plane, go to the beach, whatever.
Leave, go to Aruba.
Yeah, any non-extradition country that has a beach, you'll probably be okay.
I mean, I think this is something that is going to really have to, there's going to be a crazy learning curve, I think, for most organizations when this kicks in. It's from a consumer perspective, it's so nice to think, okay, we have a little bit more control, or at least maybe we in the U.S. don't, but across the pond, they have a little more control over their own data and can make requests to have things wiped out. But the thing that really jumped out to me from this article is talking about the response times, how short that window is. And I guess what does it mean to truly respond? Is it we're reviewing requests or is it we've taken action? And I think, you know, they make the point of overloaded IT departments where this is a whole new set of responsibilities that are being tacked on to the technical staff. I guess it remains to be seen how things are going to play out and how many requests really be coming in. But I can't help but imagine that this is going to require extra manpower for most organizations who are handling a lot of this data.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, we view everything through the context of the IT department, but for the most part, this is really a legal requirement. And I think it's, I still don't know where the line is as far as who has responsibility for those things. And I just worry that it's almost like the IT department's going to be blamed if it's not in compliance. I think that's too much to put on them to figure out all this stuff. Like, what are all the rules for all of this?
I also thought about why the lawmakers don't seek out IT people. When you're making a law and you're making some people do it and you don't know the logistics behind this type of regulation, that they should really, I feel like it helps to enlist IT people to get their perspective on stuff. Another possible event in the EU, I feel that might be controversial is, okay, yes, they want the police to easily obtain data, but they don't want them to necessarily make it easy for them to be able to read it. So that means while encryption is made available to protect the data, they're not allowing backdoors to encrypted data. So first is encrypting everything the right thing to do? And second, laws are nice, and not that I'm suggesting us to breaking it, but you know, closing back doors isn't that hard. You can kind of figure out outs and ways to go around it.
Well, people can definitely figure out ways to go around it. I mean, we saw with the WannaCry ransomware outbreak being helped pushed by the publication of known exploits from the NSA. So, you know, the government, I could only assume, has backdoors that most people are not aware of. So it's one thing to say to have a requirement that there be backdoors or not be backdoors, but that's not going to mean that some top secret intelligence agency doesn't have their own methods. Or if we saw like the case with the San Bernardino shooters and their encrypted device, the Apple iPhone, you know, the FBI ended up contracting with an external company outside of Apple to unlock that device. So, you know, iMessages by default are encrypted, end-to-end encryption, and they needed to unlock the iPhone to get that content. And, you know, they found a way to do it. Even though Apple doesn't provide a backdoor to decode those encrypted iMessages, you know, it still happens. So this law is great, but I suspect the people with the resources to get past any, you know, there's no published backdoors, they're still going to find a way in.
And I think there's a very fine line to walk between the, you know, the needs of the government to keep us safe and our need for privacy. It's kind of one of our core values, at least here in the U.S. And I think it does a great disservice to everybody in the world if we start deliberately building in weaker standards for encryption, for example. It's been tossed around, and there's been some chatter that back, I think, around the time they were looking for something to fill the what became the AES standard, that the NSA had recommended certain algorithms or libraries for how to perform the encryption and generate the random seeds. And a lot of people suspected they did that because they knew something about it to backdoor, to give them access a little bit easier. Obviously, I don't think there's any a definite answer on that, but it's something that they've been looking to do to ensure that they still have access from that perspective. But as people, I think we have that right to privacy. I think it's core and fundamental. And the government needs to, you know, do what they need to do to protect us, but there has to be a very fine line. They can't ask us to sacrifice that type of privacy that, you know, that is a core part of our values for kind of a nebulous greater good. So there's no easy answers, but I don't think that implementing a technology backdoor is the right one. That could only lead down kind of a darker path for everybody.
There's not a way to architecture a system where it's weak in only a particular way. So, you know, anytime it's a situation where you say, oh, well, we're going to put a backdoor in, so it's only the police who can access this, that has never, just empirically has never actually worked, where it's always been the case that that system has been abused either by people who do have legitimate reasons to access it, but they use it for things they should not, or in cases where it just gets entirely out of their control. And, you know, it's not, and it's a situation where bad, malicious people who have no reason to access it are able to use that as an entry point.
Okay, so let's take a real life example of what's going on in our data and systems. We've all heard of the Orange is the New Black leak, but we've never heard about the story from the people who had to go through the trauma of dealing with the Bitcoins, the FBI, and the business impact it had on this small family production studio. I think they're called Larson Studios. So what happened was on Christmas Eve, they got messages that the hackers, they're called the Dark Overlords, and they broke into their servers and they threatened to leak all the company's data. And on Christmas, they looked on their servers that, and they had in fact stolen and deleted their data, just as they said in their message. They contacted the FBI, they had to fill out these forms, but then they didn't get any guidance on how to respond to ransom demands. And so then they hired a data security company to help them. And they learned that the hackers happened to stumble upon their old computer, which was running Windows 7. They demanded 50 bitcoins, which was about $50,000 at the time, and that they learned that buying bitcoins is not the easiest thing to do in the world. And then the Hollywood studios found out, and with all this drama, they went through paying almost a six-figure, probably software or company or somebody to make sure that their data is encrypted, and now their networks are separate and all their computers are locked down. They learned a huge lesson from this. What do you think your key takeaways are from their experience?
One of the first kind of things that I thought about when I read the article was, this is kind of a classic situation where they never thought that something like this would happen to them. They never thought that, oh, who would want to, you know, steal my, you know, video production production information? And I think a lot of companies have that kind of sense, like, you know, why would this happen to me? You know, who would want to target me? And it kind of goes to the core that, you know, everybody who's in business is in business for a reason. They do something, they produce something, they work with something that's valuable. And if it's valuable to them to sustain a business, it's going to be valuable to somebody else to steal and either sell on the open market or, you know, in the case of like a ransomware, sell back to them. But there's value in all of this. So it's kind of hard for sometimes for people to wrap their head around, but you always have to kind of assume that you'll be a target either directly or in the case of this particular studio, inadvertently. These guys, I guess, were just kind of trolling out there for open machines, and they happen to find an older, you know, I don't know if it's unpatched, but an older machine with known exploits out there that allowed them to get in. So and also in that case, it was very much an opportunity of, or the crime of opportunity, I should say. They just happened to find this machine out there just trolling around and got a treasure trove of data. So that's a kind of another thing that these bad guys like to exploit. If they have the opportunity, they're going to take advantage of it.
I feel like this is a pretty unique case in the fact that the data that we're talking about is obviously high profile. So Hollywood movies and TV shows. Yeah, the company is small. I mean, it sounds like they had no real IT department. They had enough technology provided to them to, you know, allow them to run their business. But I think once, you know, they're kind of hands off at that point. And I've worked with companies like this in the past. I worked with a unnamed clothing manufacturer here in New York City, and their server, the bulk of their infrastructure was like a dusty old iMac sitting in the corner of an office, and people didn't even know that's where the data was sitting. They're about to unplug it before I stopped them. So a lot of times people are just set at the place where they have only enough money to invest in technology to enable their business and nothing more. There's no security, no firewalls. And that sounds kind of like where these people found themselves. It's an unfortunate place to be in. And I don't know what the easy solution is for companies of this size to be able to effectively protect themselves without the resources of a larger company. But you would feel, and it sounds like what's happening in response to this attack is that some of the partners of this company, some of the studios are helping with the investment in security and kind of realizing that even in industries where you don't think of a typical supply chain, you got to kind of protect all aspects of the business.
I mean, you bring up a great point there, Mike. Some of it too, in terms of a lot of these attacks, is it's just the investment that that the attackers need to put into it. In this case, it was very easy for them to exploit this machine and get in there and move around. So I don't think the strive for perfection security is necessarily the right goal, but making it difficult enough following best practices, keeping things patched, unplugging those old machines sitting around might have been enough to save them in this particular case. And that's one of those trade-offs is, when is good enough enough in certain instances.
I take a little a different approach to this, which is that, and this is something I never had considered before, which is that these content production companies are really data companies in that they have this data. They have all of the digital footage that's shot very incredibly to go and reshoot the last, couple episodes of a series or something, just impossibly expensive to do. And that because they have such a hard time recreating this data, that they're particularly vulnerable to this. And so it makes me think they must not have had very good backups. I think if they had, they wouldn't have been in this situation. I guess that's really what it came down to on my way of thinking about this. I don't know if, in particular, bigger companies are better at dealing with this. I really feel like, most of these companies need to do something that's more, I don't even know, proactive in terms of thinking about and securing their things. It makes me think like they would have been in almost the exact same trouble if, something less sensationalistic, like if their studio had caught on fire, fires are a real thing. They happen. It would have, possibly had the same business impact as, what they had through this.
So another contractor, this time a marketing firm, they were contracted by the Republican National Committee, and they stored internal documents on a publicly accessible Amazon server. And it wasn't a hack. It wasn't a breach per se, but everything was out in the open for everyone to see. You could see people's sensitive data, their research on their opponents, voting trends, wonky stats that they've created. And we have laws around consumer data and the protection of it. Why don't we have laws around these types of data and leaks when you can obviously do a lot of harm in the voting process? How should we approach this type of situation? It's, similar to the small production studio, but in a different industry, which with enormous impact.
A couple of things about this article that were kind of interesting. One, it was found completely unprotected on, I think Cindy said an AWS server, just up there, not password protected or anything, just existing. And I know we've talked about it a couple different times, that's a kind of a very classic type of, mistake. Hey, we got to put this data somewhere. We want to leverage the scalability of the cloud. Let's throw it up there. Not necessarily thinking about it. I mean, I remember Mike telling us a story about his friend who accidentally uploaded the AWS key in GitHub, and people took advantage of that. So it's a mistake. It happens. The other portion of it is that in a lot of cases, voting data is public record. So sometimes, even though there's a lot of proprietary information like the analytics around it, they don't necessarily think like, oh, it's a person, this is somebody's data. And when it's combined together like that, it could be detrimental or maybe potentially a violation of other PII type laws. And kind of on top of that too, in the way that a lot of these elections work, it's almost a very slapdash is not the right word for it, but they need to spin this up. The election cycles are fairly not short. If anybody slogged through all of the election coverage for the last 15 years that we've kind of had to live through, but they think the data goes away and kind of ages out very, very quickly. So they don't put a lot of thought into protecting it. It's useful for that very, very short time. And then it ends up just kind of existing and nobody really thinks about it, once that election day goes by.
I think something we need to get used to is the idea of the cat's kind of out of the bag in terms of data being collected about us. Cindy brought up the point of this isn't like consumer protection, like with the Target breach. I do business with a Target. They have my information. That information gets leaked. Bad. Hopefully there's some recourse for me as a consumer or some protections that can be put in place. But we're talking about companies whose entire business is trading my information, and I've never even heard of them. I've never dealt with them. They're collecting data from all sorts of different resources to make this happen. That stuff's already out there, and it's not going away. I agree that maybe there needs to be some regulatory oversight. This kind of big data business is still growing, and we've kind of talked about this a lot in past episodes of the law catching up with technology. And I think this is one place where we're just going to have to wait for that to happen, because at this point, we've all been profiled by organizations that we've never interacted with, we have no connection to, but that deed's been done.
I think it's almost faulty to blame this on like the cloud. I think that's the wrong lesson to take away from this. Just in that, you know, this was such a boneheaded move in terms of the security. Like, there's immense amounts of, you know, security configurations and tools to check and all sorts of things. And this is the equivalent of someone, you know, FTPing all this data out on a public server, probably to share with another organization or something else. And I don't know where the line between squeamishness that, oh, there's a company that knows my name that I've never heard of. Like, where's the line between that and like my name being in the phone book? Because everyone was pretty much okay with that. There were a few unlisted numbers of people. But, you know, growing up, everyone had a phone book. Everyone's name was in it. It had your address. And because, you know, that wasn't online, it was really just the people in your town could look that up. And now we're living in a much bigger town. None of the data that was in there, other than, I guess it's hard to see where it's particularly harmful if your name is in that.
Let's move on to behavioral biometrics. It's advanced to the point where people or organizations can calculate multiple data points on your eye and hand coordination and finger movements, and they can start measuring how familiar someone is with an app. It's argued that it's passive technology because it doesn't change a user's experience. And I'd say it's yes and no, because it's also saying that in my opinion, a devious way, because a user's defenses are down. You can't stop someone from tracking your behavior because you need to move or exist in order to get past a certain form, or a certain, you need to get access to information, you need to apply for stuff, and it's something that can't be helped. And behavioral biometrics, it's starting to gain ground, and it's only starting to begin. So what are some security benefits and flaws you see in this type of authentication?
I mean, I think the benefits are immediate on the surface for users. You know, the first kind of implementation I saw of this was kind of the disappearance of traditional CAPTCHAs that we're used to, where we have to, you know, input some squiggly characters to prove we're not a robot. That's going away. And a lot of times you just see now, click here to prove you're not a robot. It's just a checkbox. So it's looking at your mouse movements. It's looking at your behavioral patterns as you click that button to know that you're a human clicking that button and not a robot clicking that button. So, you know, that's kind of an easy way to kind of prove the technology. It's convenient for me. I don't want to have to read some squiggly text to buy concert tickets. So benefits being, I mean, I think bots in general are a big problem on the internet. You know, people, you know, bringing up the example of ticket buying, that's a huge problem. People always complain about, you know, big concerts, especially here in New York City. Tickets go up on sale on Ticketmaster or whoever, and they get sold out immediately. There's bots that are just ready to go to snap up all these tickets, and they go on the secondary market for huge markup. Or what we see right now in terms of politics on Twitter is like Twitter bots and spam happening and pushing agendas, and it's not coming from real people. It's coming from these like farms of Twitter bots to try and push public opinion in one way or other. So being able to cut down on bot activity on the internet, I think, is great. But the downside of this is now we're capturing behavior and you don't even realize it. There was an article on Gizmodo recently talking about how they were able to prove that companies were capturing data that you entered in a form without even submitting the form. So they basically tried to purchase something, you know, added to their shopping cart, filled out the information, and then exited, never purchased the stuff. And they received emails saying, hey, you know, you left all the stuff in your cart. You know, they're tracking the information from the form, even though you never hit submit. So that's all this background tracking is going to be happening. All your behavior on a website, mouse movements, typing, key logging is happening, and it's invisible to you. So benefits on the surface and maybe some unintended side effects happening in the background.
I think we need to be real clear about what we're talking about here. So like even this article like mixes together multiple things. Like right now, as far as I can tell, there's no actual like biometric hand-eye coordination, pressure, navigation to identify someone. That's not something that's actually happening. Now, there's some pieces of that that maybe could be used for that. And there's some, you know, nods to like other places where that's happened. Like they talk about telegraph operators and having particular, you know, signature to how they sent the dots and dashes. But no one right now is quite going through this. And I'm not sure it's really any different than the other traditional biometrics in terms of privacy and things. I guess I'm not that freaked out about this. I don't know if it would ever be that terribly accurate for the most part.
That actually, Mike, that brings up a great point. I was thinking about kind of as you guys were talking about it, I think from a user experience perspective, I'll take off my security hat for a minute. I think that would be incredibly frustrating for a user to be, you know, denied logging into your, you know, whatever, your ticket buying site because you weren't typing the way that you kind of usually type. Maybe I had an extra cup of coffee, I'm a little bit jittery. That's kind of really hard to explain to a user. Like, you didn't type the way we think you should. I think from user experience, it might be a little bit challenging or frustrating. But I think the concept is really neat in terms of a kind of an anti-fraud device. But the accuracy would have to be really spot on. And there are a lot of variables that go into it. So the practicality is maybe questionable, I guess.
I mean, one interesting thing about this is that, you know, in comparison to the last story we talked about with election data, this, by having any kind of biometric, anything related to your body as far as identification system, and typically right now that's things like retina scans and fingerprints and stuff, that does start to fall under the U.S. data breach guidelines for a couple of the different states. And we're talking a little about, like, how do these legal situations impact IT and back and forth? And something that's both good and bad about a lot of the legal statutes is they are not terribly prescriptive, that they don't get down and say, okay, you need to use this cipher, you need to use this encryption system, you need to do this. It just says, like, hey, you need to take these precautions. And it's the same with data breach regulations, where they don't get into a lot of like, hey, retina scans, they just say biometrics to kind of account for these different things. And it's this, you know, negotiation that happens over time.
What's going on in Mike's corner? Do you have a tool of the week? Oh, you do have a tool of the week.
I do. DNS Twist is this interesting tool, and it's open source, and you can go and download it right now. And what it does is, say you have a domain, like we have the Varonis.com domain. You can use this tool, and what it will do is find all of similar typo domains where someone might put in, you know, Varonis and spell it with an E instead of A. They might, you know, do Varonis.co. And we have some of those registered to prevent this, but lots of nefarious people use those typoed domains for bad things. And the article goes into some of it, but it's a really easy tool. Really applicable to almost anyone running any type of network or system. And so it's just a neat thing. So check it out, DNS Twist.
Thanks, Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, and Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Thanks.